This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome back to the Renegade Report. Let me try to take the music down. Come on.
Good morning, Jonathan. How are you doing?
As always, I can't complain. I could. Nobody cares.
Nobody cares indeed.
So we had a great previous episode. I hope everyone got to listen to it.
Franz Grenier, Institute of Race Relations. Probably our best one yet, if we had to be honest.
Yeah, I think great discussion from his side, great points, and well, we had a little bit to say here and there. But shall we get on with it?
Let's do.
All right, so today we have a gent joining us. He's Mduduzi Dlamini. Both of us came across him on Twitter, I think, for his very outspoken views, which we wanted to hear more of. I don't know if you want to add to that, but
no, he sums it up. Mr. Dlamini has a habit of releasing 20 or 30 tweets, almost an essay in tweet form, with fascinating insights.
Yeah, he's a timeline killer.
Absolutely.
Right, now that we've maligned you suitably, Mduduzi, how's it? How are you doing?
I'm fine. Good afternoon to the listeners of Renegade Report.
Thank you. All right, so lots of stuff to discuss. Ramon has been chatting with you sort of offline, so I'll let him begin.
Right. Mduduzi, you, my friend, we spoke beforehand, and we talk about Zulu culture. Can you give us just a brief history of yourself, where you grew up, what you do at the moment?
Originally, I'm from the Durban, Claremont. It's west of Durban, some 23 km off West Durban, bordering west of it. It's a place where black people bought their own land, built and their own houses. They originally built Claremont. The roads that were laid in Claremont were laid originally by black people between around 1920 and 1936. Then the municipality came over that taking over and laying a ground for laying tar on the main roads. The recent tarring just happened in post-apartheid. Before, it was dusty roads that hadn't been built entirely by black people. So I grew up in that environment of that self-sufficiency of black people, where they can do their own thing, bought land and build their own houses, own their own businesses, ramshackle small-time businesses. But it was an incipiency and a testimony that black people can do some things. One of the things that I was proud of is that five of the greatest Zulu writers lived in Claremont or were born in Claremont. I've always been proud of that. I've done an entire history of Zulu literature from 1922 to 1990. I was doing an entire research around it. I met many writers that lived in their houses, while Zulu writers lived with them. They treated me as their son and admired and appreciated them. It also gave me the sense of belonging to a proud Zulu higher culture. I was never into common law stuff, culture. It was always Zulu high culture for me that I loved best about being Zulu. There's a poem written by Vilakazi about a church in Durban, the Saints, Anglican Saint Paul's. I used to spend time sitting around that church in the afternoons, just thinking about that. Hey, Vilakazi went into this church. it had that physical connection to me. Almost all the literary map of KZN, I know it firsthand. It's not something I read from books. I've visited practically almost all the areas because it's something that I was proud of.
And Kandla included?
Yeah.
Okay. And, all right, so you've got a very good understanding of your own culture, essentially.
Absolutely. I've even translated Baudelaire, the French great poet, into Zulu. I think it's the first ever French poet into any African language that I did. It was published in 2004 by the then University of Durban-Westville, CISAL. It's out of print now. However, I'm trying to get it back in print. Someone just made an interest in it.
So what about being a Zulu? Why are you proud of being a Zulu?
One of the things that I learned when I was a child growing up, the first thing that was learned, that was inculcated on me, was when my cousin and mom read to me a Zulu novel by Dube, one of the founders of Zulu literature and a true genuine Rosanian Renaissance man who still is in my heart to this day. It's a novel called Insilaka Shaka, sort of the bodyguard of Shaka, the man who betrayed betrayed Shaka. They read that novel to me. It was before school because I got accepted at school when I was 8 years old. So that sense inculcated in me the pride that I had. When my mom started teaching me English 3 years later when I was 9 years old, it was not something that came to me as a sort of an alienation. I was well grounded in my own culture. So I was not looking for acceptance or self-acceptance from anyone else. It also helped a great deal that my entire family doted on me.
Okay, so how do you, bringing it back to sort of now and you know, the older person, how do you, because you quite buy into what I suppose many would describe as Western values, and I'm not saying that they are, I'm just saying they would be described as that. But you seem to buy into a lot of these principles, liberty, for example. And maybe you can give us an idea of the fact that these are not necessarily Western principles, that they are partly Zulu principles as well, or there's a combination there or some mutuality.
No. They're definitely Western ideas. It comes from... Yeah, it can. I'll enunciate what is actually only Zulu with respect that it's common to Western ideas. Throughout the entire Zulu literature, you have these literary gentlemen that were fascinated by English culture and Anglophiles gentlemen. Smith Sonyembezi, who died in 2004, was an English gentleman, English Zulu gentleman. H. E. Gomo, who primarily wrote in English, was through and through an English aesthetic. He's one of the founders of the ANC Youth League. You go to B. W. Vilakazi, the most illustrious Zulu writer.
The forefather, really.
Yes, was a Zulu English gentleman. You go to J.C. Dlamini, who I lived with for several years, was practically his only child. We are not related. He's one of the greatest poets in Zulu, who wrote some of the greatest ironic poems. He was an English gentleman. It's been running through. It's not foreign. It's being confident in your own culture and being able to appreciate someone else's value who adds value into yours. That's what it's about. It's properly called cultural. It's called appropriation. People hate that idea, but culture does not progress without imagination, curiosity, and appropriation. When you do not have those qualities in your own culture, then you cannot be able to have your own progresses, innovate, and develop new ideas.
So what you're saying is cultural appropriation is a positive thing.
Absolutely.
And if we don't, in essence, appropriate each other's cultures, certainly with some respect, we don't progress.
We wouldn't be drinking coffee, you and I. Coffee is originally Ethiopian. It was appropriated by Arabs. Arabs developed into a cafe. Europe appropriated it from the Arabs. It's worldwide.
And then American-made Starbucks. Yeah. And now here we are.
We wouldn't be drinking coffee in the first place if there wasn't no cultural appropriation.
So you don't get offended by these ideas of, you know, people saying, they refer to their cultures. We did this or we built that. It doesn't, you know, you don't find it racist, for example. I think, you know, the David Bullard example, which is commonly thrown around, you know, I don't know if you recall that article. I found problems with that article. I certainly did. But I'm interested to know your views on that, because it's an interesting kind of position to be in, where you sort of find value in certain cultures and you find fault in your own, perhaps. And this situation we have in South Africa at the moment, where people are very anti other cultures. You know, we want to get back to our roots necessarily. It's happening all over the place. So you've got Afrikaner nationalism on the one side. You've got, I don't know, I would call it Zulu nationalism or what I would call it.
Or Afro-nationalism.
Yeah. So there's a lot of this, you know, and this anti kind of the colonial thing. I think the Bullard article was very much a colonial type argument about, colonialism wasn't all bad. It brought some of this stuff here. So where do you stand on that kind of view? Because it's a fine line. You must admit.
First of all, David Bullard is a great satirist, writer, humorous writer, and I mostly enjoyed him since I was young.
And he's a listener of the show, so
I still have.
He'll appreciate the compliment.
Yeah, I'm sure he will.
He and I have had some correspondences. I would have loved him to write for me for my magazine that I'm wanting to start. That is, obviously, I do have its website. I love David Bullard. He was entirely misunderstood. He was a provocative contrarian. However, in any case, when you look at colonialism and you look at the benefit that it has brought into Africa, there would be no Western medication, for instance. There would be no Christianity. Many people are Christians, are dying by Christianity. It was brought by Western colonialism. If they are anti that colonialism, they'll renounce Christianity in the first place. You find that how South Africans have developed entirely, and how Africa has developed and appropriated aspects of Western culture that came via colonialism. It's unfortunate that it was brutal, but we must always remember that it was during the times of the wars of conquest. My own people, Zulu people, conquered Southern Africa as far as Zambia. So if I'm to denounce the era of conquest that was at the time was, I'll be subjective and looking at it from a point of view of my own parochialism. What you are asking about is not probably because it's Afrikaner nationalism or Afro-nationalism. Zulu nationalism had it. It's heyday as well. It has died in the post-apartheid. IFP represented that Zulu nationalism. We fought against that. My parents died in the battle against those things. Right now, what you find, what is common, is precisely what is called ethnocentrism, where you find each legal group believes in the superiority of their own group. It's proto-racism. That is what leads to racism. I'm against that.
Okay, so I mean, I think we're getting into the sort of collectivism ground.
Yes.
So Mduduzi, so are you saying that, I mean, a culture that is finds fulfillment within itself would happily take on other cultures in terms of a learning experience, so to speak?
Definitely. Definitely. That's why we can see the English comfortable with appropriating things that are from French.
Right.
Or from the Germans.
Or Indian food.
Or Indian food, because they are confident in themselves.
Yes.
They do not feel threatened by the foreign, by the strange.
So it's a positive thing to appropriate another culture.
Absolutely. We wouldn't be... how Western imperialism and colonialism began, remember that it's about spices.
Yes, indeed.
It was about the track to get the spices. Columbus landed in the wrong place. Looking for spice.
Yes, he went to the West Indies.
Yeah,
instead of India.
So, without this appropriation of one another's culture, there will be no progress in any one of us.
But you
require confidence in your own to be able to appropriate what is foreign and strange and beautiful.
You seem like quite a sort of history aficionado. At least you have a good appreciation of history.
Yeah.
So I'm getting the sense from a lot of what you say. I personally have a huge problem with history revisionism. I think that's part of the issue with my objection to Rhodes Must Fall, for example.
Absolutely.
In that if you judge Rhodes by today's standards, he's absolutely a terrible human being. You know, he would probably last about 6 hours in the real world. Ramon's disagreeing. You can butt in.
Yes, I mean, but was he a terrible human being? He was a persecuted homosexual in a time where homosexuality was a sin. I mean, he physically did not kill anyone. I mean, his business practices were a bit, you know, suspicious. But at the time, he was seen as quite progressive in terms of how he appropriated wealth.
I think that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that, you know, in 2015, 2016, we would look at Rhodes and say, look, that behavior today, that's not how we do things. And that's not good enough. And you either need to change or you can't do that. Or you may even be up for some sort of criminal charges for some of the stuff he did. But back then, he wasn't actually amongst the group of people he was around. And so I'm using that as one example of revisionism of history. But I think we have this problem worldwide where we are trying to sort of revision history. And also it's in the constant battle to find out who's the biggest victim, you know. So, for instance, slavery is a part of the history revisionism in which black Americans will say, you know, well, we were slaves. The fact that there were plenty of people who were enslaved across history of many races, religions, cultures, etc., seems to be besides the point. So tell us a little bit about what you think about history revisionism, about your appreciation for history and your understanding.
Obviously, I deplore and despise history revisionism. If I were to then denounce Rhodes according to my to the standards of today, it would mean that I have to denounce Shaka, one of the greatest heroes.
Absolutely.
Who I have grown up till today revering him. That's what it would mean
to
me.
In the context of his time, he still was a hero.
He was a hero. He is a hero of the. So one thing that I objected on the same grounds with Rhodes Must Fall, that to show that if your argument was that Rhodes was a racist, let me show you that racists actually are confused generally. Rhodes hated the Germans. When he spoke, he also spoke about the English race. Now, that's a nationality. It's a people. It's not even a nationality. It's a people within a nationality of the British. But when he was speaking about the English, they were a race as far as he was concerned, because that was at the time of their own confusion as people who believed in racism theory. However, what he did at those times, you're correct, he was not the only one. That's how mining began, the mineral revolution in South Africa. Practically everyone who wasn't in the mineral revolution was a criminal. They were robbing one person against the other.
Yeah.
That's what obtained at the time. That
and sticking their pick in the ground and going, this is my mind.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're going to then use the current standards to judge that period, you absolutely have no appreciation and no sense of history, and you shouldn't be talking about history at all in the first place.
Whereas I do believe that you can judge history in its context and still make a judgment based on morality. So, for example, I don't think the Holocaust could be excused under any circumstances whatsoever.
It was not even excusable at that time.
Indeed, yes.
It was not even excusable at that time. Oh, it's the same thing with slavery. It was not even. You had these abolitionists.
Yes.
They were whites. With the one or two slaves that had just escaped slavery.
Oh, absolutely. The Republican Party in America, that's what they won on.
Thomas Paine was positively against slavery.
Indeed.
So it was never accepted even at the time. Right throughout the entire history, you find these people were opposing it ruthlessly.
Indeed. And that's the problem with history. It's very easy to try and have broad strokes around what people did and why they justified what they did. But there's so much nuance within it. And I think as a student of history, one must be aware of that.
One of the unfortunate things that have been happening since 1990 across ideas, although that it has before 1990, it has about a 30-year period of gestation. You get this. You had these people who, because of their own inadequacies, looking at their anxieties, looking at the achievements that have been appropriated by the world as positive from the Western culture, they then began this these notions of dead white European men. You find those people that then started to propagate the learning of texts that were quite easy because somehow someone is a woman or is black or because they were victims of some previous system. But that's not what it's about in life. Or that's not what's about what even the intellects demand. Or the intellect is a great demand. It doesn't do well with something that is easy. It doesn't see to where it despises anything that is easy. It always wants something that is difficult.
Indeed. So are you arguing that people who are intellectually intelligent, for the lack of a better word, do not see things in binary terms?
Generally, they don't. There's no. It's one of the unfortunate things that came out. Of anti-racism, the inculcation of the binary vision amongst anti-racists, propagating it to a remnant outspoken black people, that doesn't obtain generally, especially from Bantu languages. You don't find it; it's not across. You wouldn't find black people when they're talking in their own languages, or viewing or the world in a binary vision. They don't do that. It doesn't obtain. This is something that has been inculcated by people who have been alienated from their own people.
Okay, that's an interesting view. So are you arguing that what we term anti-racist, so people who want to see racism in every many aspects of life. So are you saying that they might feel alienated from their own culture, their own race themselves?
Absolutely. Most of them it's a sense of alienation, of not belonging to your own people, lacking confidence. It has this inferiority complex that I call pathological. That's why it's so aggressive. It asserts itself so aggressively against even empirical evidence and empirical observation of relations among people. It's because it's a deep sense of alienation.
Because that is quite interesting, because you'll never hear King Zwelithini, you know, speak about white people. I do understand your point. I mean, I haven't seen data to back it up, but cognitively to me, it sort of makes sense.
Certainly. You find that's the reason probably someone like a Zulu nationalist or like Chief Buthelezi had no problem with it because he grew up confident in his own culture. His mom is one of the greatest Zulu singers or music composers. So he had this natural confidence in himself.
So if you would then say, you know, oh, well, he's Zulu or he's black, so we must give him a step up, you would find that deeply insulting.
Absolutely. I find it, I was arguing against that. I used to have a librarian in 1996, so a colored woman who was practically my mom, is my other mom as well, in the library. When this notion of affirmative action was first brought up, I felt very uncomfortable about it, because it assumes an infantile disposition of black people. As a black person, you cannot do anything with your own abilities unless you are treated specially and differently as some sort of a child. I found it deeply patronizing and condescending. I argued against it. I'm still arguing against it. There's considerable research demonstrating in US that black pupils who've been accepted through affirmative action in predominantly white school in US do badly than black pupils who go to historical black institutions. It's because underneath it is this assumption that these people must be accepted in this school because they're not good in themselves.
But there's an argument that, I mean, apartheid took away, you know, opportunities like we have not seen before. The social engineering was atrocious, for example. So, for example, you know, black people could not study where they wished to. Their education was inferior. So maybe after after 1994, does not make sense that black people will need, so to speak, a step up, because the skills that they lack has been due to state interference in their lives.
But the skills deficit is still there. So how do you argue what affirmative action has done for black people?
So when is it an implementation problem or an actual entire program?
It's a conceptual program itself. When your concept or idea is wrong, your implementation is going to be wrong, because the concept itself is wrong.
Because I mean, thankfully you say this, because when I say this, it gets uncomfortable around people. But if you look at historical analysis and you look at data from around the world, oppression has been happening around the world and still exists in many countries. And you do find, personally, if there is a revolution, so to speak, to a more liberal democratic society, the less the state does, the more people empower themselves, and you get emergent structures of wealth and society coming through, and that happens naturally.
It's exactly the argument that I had, that gradualism through a proper education would have now taken black people far. Or we could see this between the period of leading up to 2007, with the growth of the black middle class.
Yes.
I remember many people they still argue in the middle class like me, saying that they are in those positions thanks to the ANC government policy. No, they are wrong. They're not there thanks to the ANC government policy.
Yeah, don't you find that horribly patronizing? I mean, I know you've used that word, but isn't it terrible to, like, say, it's the same argument I have partially. I mean, white privilege, I think, is a lot of crap. But one of the problems with the argument of privilege, it's the same as saying a black guy got there because he's black. No, he got there because he's good at what he does. If you're saying he got there because he's black, it's incredibly insulting. It's the same as the white privilege argument. Everything a white person has must be because they're white. No. Do you think maybe they studied for years or worked hard, long nights, days, etc.? These are the problems with these arguments. They remove
agency from the individual.
Absolutely. That's 100% the correct word.
So when they make that argument, I look at them and laugh. I said, no. Even the data doesn't support what you're saying. Because when you look at unemployment, affirmative action and PA has done nothing for black people as far as unemployment is concerned. Yeah. So you would have been employed anyway.
Indeed, that's the irony of BEE. Thomas Sowell, a great, if I may say, black economist, one of my favorites, he wrote a book called Affirmative Action Around the World. And the key thing about it, it helps people that don't need help at all. It helps people that are educated in university. It helps people that have the skills necessary to be a marketing manager in a corporation. But it's not going to help the hawker, you know, on the side of the street, or the unemployed man who lives in Alexandria. It's not going to help him one bit.
I've heard about that book. I still want it. I haven't read any single book of Thomas Sowell, unfortunately. I'd love to read that book. Because when you look at affirmative action, where it has been put as a policy around the world, it fails the people that it is intended to help.
Yeah, good intentions, that whole thing once again.
Yes.
You know, we say that often. It's interesting. The other day, another podcaster I was listening to, it was Gareth interviewed, I forget the gentleman's name. He's on, I think, Metro FM. He's one of the evening DJs. He had a very, controversial point. He even said, before he said it, he said, I'm going to, you know, get in trouble for saying this. He turned around and said, you know, he comes from Soweto, I can't remember if it was Meadowlands or one of the other areas there. And he was saying that obviously they were very proud of their area when he grew up there. You know, people were proud to say they come from Meadowlands or they come from Orlando or wherever they come from.
Yes, you can find even some popular songs backing that up.
Yeah. And he even talked a little bit towards township rivalry in terms of between those or between other townships in Pretoria. And so,
they still exist.
But what he said, which was controversial, was he said that he remembers people having more jobs back then, than he does now, what he sees. Now, that's obviously very anecdotal, in terms of...
Yes, limited to his experience.
Yeah, you know, and I'm not sure if that's necessarily true, but I'm bringing up the point to talk about sort of how, you know, we've mentioned your views on BE, on employment equity, and how it hasn't helped the people it's meant to help, which is those people. Okay.
Yeah.
And we know the data speaks for itself because the unemployment statistics are there to kind of back up that anecdotal evidence. He did caveat it by saying, look, the guy may have, he was working and for a minimum wage and it was a terrible minimum wage and he couldn't.
But he was working.
But he had a job and he said people were proud and he spoke about how essentially a job gives you dignity. That's what it gives you. And I think, you know, we're missing that. We know factually that we're missing that in terms of jobs for people and work. So where do you stand sort of socially, economically on how we solve some of our problems?
Let me explain. The data that we have, unfortunately, doesn't go with as far as employment with respect to black people, doesn't go beyond 1990. So it can never be presented backed by data whether black people had unemployment then or not. Yeah. However, remember that there was influx control.
Yeah.
So black people can only be brought into the, can only come into the city or when
they
were working. So it's probable that all the black people were around the city then were working. There's a probability. However, specifically as far as labor data, it begins in 1994. In 1990, what we have with respect to data is pure guesswork. It's in a helicopter flew around where black people lived and then took topographic maps of where black people lived during the day. So counting the black people that were there during the day and not there during the day, then that's how then they were, made that guess estimate of who was working on
which
that.
Which sounds incredibly inaccurate.
Absolutely. That was 1990.
Yeah.
Beyond that, there's absolutely nothing. That argument is a mute one with respect to that. However, employment does give people dignity as far as they can obtain it for themselves, get it for themselves without any or some sort of a nanny or a nurse putting them through the field. One of the best forms of getting jobs, the network that most of us black people do not use, which we have, is the person who's working. You can always find a job by someone who's working who can recommend you to another company, or to a company where they are working. But we don't do that once you become black middle class. Because why? We leave the places where we're living. So we are no longer connected to some of the people who need employment. When we can say, hey, there's an employer. Hey, I know a guy who can do this. So the employer employs that person on your recommendation. It's still the best form of networking, but we don't use that social capital. Mm. Instead, we go around complaining that we black people do not have social capital when we do have it. It's just that we're not using it effectively.
But not in the middle class, is what you're saying. There was a book, sorry to interrupt, a book called Capitalist Nigger, written in 2001.
By
a Nigerian economist, and he made the point that this happens with black communities that are in foreign lands, so to speak, not in Africa. And he gives an example of, for example, Pakistanis and Asians and Koreans and excuse me, and Jews to some extent. Mm. If you find them in a community, say a Korean community, in a foreign country. The social networks between those people is extremely high. The societal trust factor is extremely high. Amongst black people, it's lacking. And he didn't explain why, so to speak. But he just said this is an issue that needs to be dealt with.
Okay. Unfortunately, I despise that writer you mentioned, and I despise him because what he was writing in English was written by John Tobe in 1922 in Zulu. It's there. It's just that ignorance of black people who do not know. So I hated the fact it became a cause celebre, the book, because it had nothing new. Right. John Tewa says this thing as far back as 1922. It's written in a Zulu essay. Yes, that's quite true. The social trust, we are a low social low trust people. It's unfortunate. I'm going to draw an example about someone quite intimated and close to me, but I'm just not going to mention her name because obviously she's someone who's intimate to me. When she moved to US some 15 years ago, she did her best to help any South African who was arriving in US to acclimatize, get jobs. She would put them up in an apartment, live with them, feed them. But 4 or 6 years down the line, they all betrayed him. From that betrayal she got from those people, she stopped having interaction of whatsoever any kind with South Africans. Because she has the experience of being betrayed by people that she's helped who had nothing when they arrived in US. And some of them even didn't have the visas to return. They overstayed they are welcome in US. She helped all those people. But in return, she got a thankless plate from them. So you get that experience. It happens. I also have it. It's something that I always say that when I was a bureau chief, I've got about 17 people who are working, who are trained and brought into employment into journalism by me. At that time, at that age, I don't know anyone who could have made that achievement, but I did. I was young. They're still working till today. Only two of those guys still say, hey, you know, Mtutuzi, we owe our living to you. The rest of them had never even gave me a thank you. You get the all of them, not a single all of them were black.
Right. I mean, we're not saying it's a black cultural thing to do but, this, right?
No, but it's
universal, to be honest.
It isn't, as he was pointing out. Mm. You find these communities that come. You find look at Bangladeshis here. You look at Pakistanis. You look at Ethiopians. Mm. You look at the social trust. Mm. That is amongst them. When they find opportunities, he goes, he looks for another Ethiopian.
Mm.
to bring into that opportunity. We don't do that.
So not universal, but certainly it's something to be aspired to within certain communities. It's not an everyone thing.
It isn't, but it's that social capital that needs to be to be utilized amongst black people. But it requires trust.
Mm.
When there's no trust, that can a society doesn't function.
So why is that trust missing in South Africa as an example? I mean, you know, black people aren't enemies of each other in South Africa. Those who argue that we have a race war would argue that whites and blacks are enemies. But you know, what's stopping the trust?
The funny thing is that there are people who say that there's never been a race riot in South Africa since 1949. There's only been anti-immigrant riots in the post-apartheid. That's quite a notable contrast. It's something that I haven't thought about it, why there isn't enormous social trust. However, I've argued for trust since I was 17. That is the basis of a foundation and society. I remember my first entry into a formal job when I was 17. I came, there were two white guys working there. There were some four Indians. By the time of 3 years, my employer had replaced virtually all of the way up, but three left. He said, no, this guy can do all your job. It was about the trust that I had gained with the employer. So he fired white guys, Indian guys. He's Muslim. He fired them. He said, no, this guy can do your job. It's about the trust when you tell someone, look, when you work in this place, don't steal. Don't do this. Don't do those things. Because when you do them, you're not only affecting yourself. You're affecting other people. You look at retail shop right now. At all the retail shops, you look at the employees being searched when they leave their workplaces. That thing in 1990 didn't exist. There were no security guards at retail shops. As far as until 1993. It began to exist when stealing in retail became so enormous that retail owners could not accommodate it. Then they implemented private plainclothes security to monitor their own staff. They implemented security to search their own staff. Why? Because they created those conditions of being untrusted by their own employers.
Right, so let's change track a little bit, if you don't mind.
Yes, I'd like to. There's a topic of alienation that I'd like that we return to. Roman and I had spoken of before about it with respect to black consciousness and.
Roman, you want to tell us a bit more?
So before the show, Umduduzi and I were speaking about half an hour, and he made the claim, a very surprising claim to me, that Steve Biko is actually not well known. amongst our black
opponents. What, the name's known
his work and his name. So please explain a bit more about that, because that is something I found very interesting.
In 1989, Penguin first released the first available imprint edition in South Africa, Steve Biko's work. I wrote what I like. I bought it. I was the only person who bought it in CNA in workshop. It was the only copy that came. I bought it. I read it. I was in standard 9 then. I read it. First copy. There was nothing new in his book. He was rehashing everything that George Padmore or Kwame Nkrune or Frantz Fanon had said, or even Malcolm X had said, there's nothing new in Steve Biko. He's a pastiche of everything that had been thought. It's not surprising. He was a medical student, not trained in ideas. He knows nothing about ideas. He has not a single new idea.
Wow.
We thought it was controversial on this show to say that Steve Biko was a racist before, but I think that takes the cake.
So he's not actually well-read amongst...
No, he isn't.
Amongst South Africans.
No, he isn't well-read. So when So the people who was into Steve Biko were small groups of PAC. So during then we were all young adolescents. So I spent my time arguing with them, and then I would argue against black consciousness, that it was a false consciousness affected of alienation. Steve Biko had come from a small rural town in Eastern Cape, came to Durban, a big city back then, first time seeing white people. It was a shock to his system. He knew nothing. He had never seen a white person. He had never been placed in a position where he could see a white person on a day-to-day basis. He became shocked. The entire experience became an alienation from him, transplanted from a rural town into an urban theater. That's how he informed his perspective. That's what's generally forgotten by people who argue for him, that he was an alienated person. So this black consciousness thing, you don't even find equivalent of it in any of the black languages. It's one of the things that is ironic when you read him is that he used to speak about non-Europeans, the language of the time. Now, if you were to judge him according to his time, now, here's this guy who referred to black people as non-Europeans. He was black, but he referred to black people as well as non-Europeans. If you then you to do the argument of history revisionism, then you would also have to apply it to Steve Biko as well, which is would be unfair, right? Because it was at the time that he was speaking, it was the language that was available to him at the time. However, his pastiche and weak arguments back then, they were completely had no substance. What I do agree and do admit to is that Steve Biko is a political figure. He's got some substance, but as a thinker, no, he has no substance at all.
So what do you mean by saying there's no such thing as black consciousness in African language? What do you mean by that?
Yes, for instance, in a Zulu language, even in a Sotho language, there's nothing that's called black consciousness.
You can't talk about it.
It doesn't exist.
And as a concept, I mean, you obviously don't like it.
Yes, as a concept, it doesn't even exist as a concept.
Even as a concept?
As a concept, it doesn't exist as a concept. So you'd have to import it from English and translate it now into Bantu languages. Now, this would be ironic for someone who says he's black, who has now to use the very language that he pretends to hate to appropriate this concept into their own language. Their mother language.
That's fascinating. So you would argue that most black South Africans don't give two cents about Steve Biko and his ideas.
He has no resonance. Black consciousness has never had resonance. One of the foremost parties that subscribe to it, ASAPO and PAC, where are they?
Right. Well, that's proof there.
All right. So what about the EFF, who have sort of, you know, bringing it back?
EFF has no ideology. It only propagates the politics of hatred. It's jumping to everything that it considers popular among blacks. The person who had brought this to EF originally is one of the founders, Andile Mqhitama. The rest, the entire concept before Andile Mqhitama was with EFF. It's a foreign one. I know Fletch Shivambo, I know Chiles Malem had arguments with them in 2009 that were very unpleasant. Before then, Steve, this people consciousness. So it's what they imagine is popular amongst black people, because they're now trying to appropriate Andile Mqhitama's record. Right. You can think of this as how Soviet Russia communism would do, appropriating Trotsky's ideas and now trying to present it as Stalin's ideas.
So black consciousness doesn't exist on its own. It's other ideas which people then say are black consciousness.
Yes.
Not even a chicken and the egg, really. It's actually black consciousness doesn't exist without you making as if your ideas fit into this thing called black consciousness.
A sort of a black consciousness equivalent that existed in West Africa in the mid-20th century was a negritude. Franz Fanon,
Franz Fanon, famous.
Used to laugh at it. he mocked it.
Mm.
So it's quite funny that the people who are claiming to be black consciousness here in South Africa try to appropriate Frantz Fanon to this black consciousness. He would have laughed at it.
Really? Well, what if you had to describe Negritude?
Negritude was founded by the Senegalese and poet Sangor, as well as the Caribbean poet César in France. They were alienated intellectuals in France. Sangor had just been transplanted from Senegal to France in the mid-20th century. Same with César. So when they came there, coming from this entirely black nation, now finding themselves in Paris, where you could probably count black people on your hand, back then it was a shock to them. Mm. So their natural reaction was this negritude, this ethnocentrism, pride in their own blackness.
As a reaction to the environment.
As their reaction to the alienation
you speak of. So it's I feel alienated and insecure, so I'm going to make something to protect myself.
Yeah, absolutely.
And who I am and what I believe I symbolize.
Negritude, in contrast to black consciousness, at least had solid intellectual foundations.
Right.
It goes across
cultural.
And
ethnic lines.
Yes, it was cultural ethnic lines. From that point of view, it's immensely better than the rubbish of black consciousness.
All right. We've got a little bit of time left,
yeah.
So I want to talk a bit about sort of geopolitics, because you've got lots of opinions, which suffice it to say you would never make it into the current South African foreign ministry with your opinions. So you're not a huge fan of someone like Vladimir Putin trying to retake the USSR. You're not a big fan of Barack Obama either. You think you probably would agree with me. I think he's one of the worst American presidents ever. Let's go into some of those opinions.
My own foreign perspective and policy, my own foreign perspective is that it's the Western culture is our heritage.
Okay.
Even as a Zulu.
Yes, it's our heritage. It might have come, unfortunately, via imperialism and colonialism, but it's here. We cannot now undo it. It's a part of history. It's a part of our heritage. So for South African government to have this anti-Western perspective and foreign policy that driving it towards China and Russia, disreputable countries as far as their own treatment of their own people and polities, more inclined to authoritarianism rather than democratic ethos, or it alienates South Africa from its natural environment. We are driving the ANC government is driving South Africa because of ANC's experience during exile and the apartheid time towards nations that we should not be associating with at all. Russia is a dark authoritarian country. It espouses authoritarianism. The same as China. It's right. Same millennia.
And they're both horribly illiberal.
And the constitution, I always laugh at when people accuse me that, no, well, you're illiberal. You don't know. You're living in a liberal democracy. You just don't know. The constitution of South Africa is a liberal democracy constitution.
Yeah, very, very progressive document.
Yes.
Just not accepted by a lot of people.
Yes. So I find it fun when people are thinking that it's abusive to me. It's something that I'm proud of. Or it's something that it was ingrained in me and my mom ingrained in when I was born. But to return to the geopolitics, that South Africa has to align itself with the Western powers. Singapore did it. Singapore is a post-colonial nation. When it came out in 1965, when it came out even of its federal arrangement with Malaysia, it didn't reject its Western heritage. What it did instead was to fully embrace it, because it then showed confidence amongst themselves as Singaporeans, and they've been progressive since then. Oh, they aligned their own interest with the West. That's for me is. President Obama has been one of the worst presidents ever, in that he subscribed to anti-Americanism as an American himself.
That's true.
He's weakening America from within. He left the the international stage to all the evil forces that some people in their delusion, especially from feminists, if this delusion comes from feminists, that there's no evil in the world and cruelty. Oh, which there is. Which
well,
there is.
There's massive cruelty on the campuses in America, but otherwise...
Yes,
you know.
But the feminists do not see it in that way. They think you can engineer a human being to be without cruelty or evil. But that's not the case.
No, of course not.
Yeah. So Barack Obama has bought all into these ideas that are anti-Western, anti-America. He then is implementing the policies, the perspective of the anti-Americans and anti-West in U.S. foreign policy. Hopefully that all is going to be reversed after his presidency. But we need to reverse it here in South Africa as well. Our position that has taken us to the arms of China and the arms of Russia. We have. I admire the Russian culture. It's one of the superb culture in the cultural expression in the world. However, their polity from the time of their autocracy, the Romanovs, till today, is one of autocracy and dark authoritarianism. We cannot accept that part of their heritage. So it is deeply anti-democratic, illiberal. We cannot have it.
But I do think sometimes the ANC faces a bit of paranoia, despite the fact that we are a constitutional liberal democracy. They sometimes still believe they're under attack, you know, from the West. And you can see it in their press releases.
Yes.
You know, Tulibano said it's a CIA spy. And
Third forces.
Yeah, third force. It's not taken seriously, but I do think a lot of ANC members in the party itself still do believe that foreign forces are trying to undermine.
Well, can I just say that I also think that they misinterpret what is normal market forces, which are open and there's no secret about it. This is how the capitalist world works. They interpret market forces to be Western forces. So, for example, if a political party gets a donation from an American company, then that's a, you know, third force interference. No, that's not third force interference. That's how it works. And the fact that you know it exists even proves that it's not a third force. So, I mean, comment on that?
Absolutely. It's among the elite of the ANC. It doesn't obtain among the general populace. I was a member of the ANC. My branch here in Johannesburg actually was in Soweto, Orlando East. My branch before when I moved up from Durban. This doesn't obtain among the general membership. It's amongst the elite of the higher echelons. It's obviously unfounded, as you point out. However, this anti-Westernism does not originate with ANC founding principle. It originates around the mid 1940s when the SACP takes over ANC. Between 1912 and 1944, ANC is pro-Western.
Right. Okay.
Liberal, pro-Western. That's why they even made entries, went to London, to the Queen, to make presentation against the treatment of black people, asking for the Queen to intervene on behalf of the black people, because that's what their general liberal principle made them to believe.
Yes.
That they belong to the West. However, when the SACP, which ironically was a racist party against black people, then throws in its lot in 1944 with the ANC, changes the whole dynamics and the perspective of ANC. From that point onwards, it's even something that I wish I could have. Sometimes I wish that I could just dedicate to writing book instead of trying to make a living. This is my contention that I've not seen elsewhere anyone makes. SACP and ANC cost us our liberation.
The SACP?
Yes, cost us the liberation of black people. The liberation of black people could have come much earlier. But the ANC throwing in sludge with the SACP in 1944, brings about, this is, remember that this is just on the eve of the end of World War II, the beginning of the Cold War, when there's this fight between against the liberal West and against communism.
Yes.
So when ANC throws in its lot with the Communist Party, it effectively invited the West to be anti it.
So essentially the West says, all right, well, we would help them, but they're part of our enemy, essentially.
Absolutely. That's what happened. That's what exactly happened. That not only that, even here in South Africa, when the apartheid government in 1950 passes the Anti-Communist Act, it didn't pass the Anti-ANC Act.
Yes.
It passed the Anti-Communist Act. ANC gets banned because of this of their alliance with the SACP. Had they terminated their alliances, they wouldn't have been banned.
Yeah.
They were functioning throughout then, under proto-apartheid during those difficult times. Here in South Africa, they were not banned because they were not Communist Party. But the moment they threw in their lot with communism, they invited their own banning.
Own demise, yeah.
That's what happened.
Damn it, Mduduzi.
We're out of time.
We're out of time at the biggest cliffhanger.
Yeah, no, but I want to give you 30 more seconds. I want to ask you, you've got a good idea of the ANC. Can they fix themselves from where they are?
This is it's a difficult question.
In 30 seconds.
There are two answers to it. First one, they can't. They can't fix it. ANC cannot reform. It has no ability to reform. Secondly, it can do it only when it allows individuals to propagate ideas that can challenge or that can be competitive among itself, and then the winning ideas will succeed. It doesn't do that.
Okay, so thank you. I'm sure we can actually get into that as a full hour at some point in the future. That's been just over an hour with Mduduzi Dlamini. You can find Mduduzi on Twitter. His Twitter handle, a little bit complicated, it's Quibi. So that's Quibbie and then underscore. Obviously, you can find us at Renegade_Report. Ramon, cheers. Wait, you're back on. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Fascinating podcast as ever.
Yeah.
And we would love to have Mduduzi back in the near future.
Yeah. All right. So Ramon at Ramon Kavanagh, spelled Roman, at Jonathan_Witt. And please visit us on Facebook, like us. And guys, if you're liking this podcast, we really would appreciate a rating on iTunes. You can go there. Of course, you want to give us 5 stars. We deserve all of them. We are entitled to all of them. We know you want to leave a nice comment about how much your puppet loves our show. Thanks so much, and bye.
Okay, I didn't know about it. Thank you.
This is CliffCentral.com.